So then we'll continue with the theme of the retreat, often called right intention or wise intention, sometimes called right thinking, right resolve. I kind of like the idea of attitude, the skillful attitude. Most commonly it's called intention. And I don't know what it does for you when you hear the word intention, but in my mind it has a feeling of being very specific, you know, like this is the intention, the purpose for why I'm doing something. And I kind of associate it with a kind of a narrowing of focus. To me, this, you know, I'm focusing on this now because I'm intending this. And whereas I think this factor of the Eightfold Path is more literally means thinking, sankappa, but it means to think with. The word kappa means to think, sam means with, co-thinking, thinking that goes along with everything else. So it's a way of thinking. So the way in which we approach whatever we're doing, the way we think about what we're doing. So it's more the accompanying way of attitude about how we reflect and consider what we're doing in our life, as opposed to the specific intention that we have. I might have the intention maybe to wash the dirty dishes of my fellow retreatants. And that's nice to get it done. And if that's all it is, then you want to get done as quickly as you can and speed through it or something. But what's the way of thinking, what's the approach, the attitude towards doing the dishes or the pot washing or whatever job you have? And it's possible to have an attitude of generosity. I'll do this in my way of caring for my retreatants. Or I could do it from an attitude of greed. I need to finish this as quickly as I can so I can get back to my meditation. My meditation is the most important thing going here. And everything else is just a nuisance. And these dishes even more so. And these people who keep bringing dishes. You know, don't they understand? My meditation. So that's, you know, that's a way of thinking. Or it might be a certain kind of aversion. Like, you know, I know some people for whom everything's kind of like an oppressive. Everything's kind of like an obstacle for them. And so here comes one more dish. It happens to be the first dish that's showed up, but it's the attitude, oh no, one more dish. As an attitude. As opposed to an attitude of generosity. Oh, I'd like to take care of my fellow retreatant. This is my job right now. I get to do this, so they don't have to do it. Or an act of goodwill. You know, if I do this in a mindful, careful, maybe a little bit quiet way, it makes the environment just a little bit nicer for my coworkers, for the people still eating in the dining room. And so it's a kind of a caregiving that goes into how you are doing it. And so it's the attitude with which we approach our life. And this attitude thing, underlying attitude, can be quite a deep thing inside of us. It can touch some of the deepest, can come from some of the deepest places we have. And almost instinctual, perhaps. And and some of it is not so, what's deep inside and instinctual, some of it is not so so noble, and some of it is noble. And the instinct towards hostility is pretty deep in human beings. Otherwise it wouldn't have been around for millennia. The instinct for sensual pleasures, pretty deep drive that we have. The instinct for harm, violence, cruelty. It's also pretty deep in human beings. And what's also very deep in us is the instincts towards letting go, not holding on, not gripping so hard. Strong instinct to look for relief and release. It's also a deep, strong instinct for goodwill, caring for others, caring about others. And there's a deep instinct for compassion. And those are the three skillful, three wise, three right intentions, intention for letting go, the intention for, or the attitude of letting go, the attitude of goodwill, loving kindness, and the attitude for compassion. So we have these two kind of, you know, almost maybe competing instincts within us. And I think they both deserve our deep respect, but they have different consequences, and maybe they come from different places within us. And what do we want to strengthen? What do we want to develop? Where do we want to come from? So one of the stories that the Buddha gives of himself in his search for awakening before he was enlightened, he tells a story of deciding or making a decision that's like this. Suppose that I divide my thoughts into two classes. Then I set on one side thoughts of sensual desire, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of cruelty. I set on the other side thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of goodwill, and thoughts of compassion. As I abided thus, a thought of sensual desire arose in me, and I understood. This thought of sensual desire has arisen in me. This leads to my own affliction, to others' affliction, and to the affliction of both. It obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from Nibbana. When I consider this, it subsided in me. When I consider this obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from Nibbana, it subsided in me. Whenever a thought of sensual desire arose in me, I let go, removed it, and did away with it. So here he divides his attitudes, the way of thinking, into two different classes. And then he recognized the consequences of what happens when he's in the grip of the unskillful ones. And he does the same thing for ill will and for cruelty. That he sees that it leads to affliction for himself, for others, and for both self and others. And this concern that you see repeatedly in the Buddha, for this kind of total kind of concern for others, and that equally, concern for oneself, concern for others, and then the self and others I take to be us, kind of what we're all together, the system, the community. And you don't want to only take care of oneself, only take care of one other person, but you want also sometimes you need to take care of the unit, the group as a whole, the society as a whole. And occasionally the welfare of the group takes precedent over the welfare of the individual. And sometimes the individual takes precedent over the group. But to kind of look at what is it that causes harm to all these different categories is part of the deep reflection that goes behind Buddhist thought. What causes harm? So he recognized that when I had these particular kinds of thoughts of sensual desire, they led to harm. He also saw that they obstructed wisdom and led to all kinds of difficulties. In terms of sensual desire, lust, for example, I'm not going to ask you to show of hands, but Jack Kornfield used to ask, who hasn't made a fool of themselves with their sexual desire? And it's amazing. I don't know what you guys would do, but When he does it, the huge majority of the people in the group raise their hands. And then a few people who don't, they have some doubts, maybe they didn't hear the question. And we know in our society there's lots of harm in all kinds of ways people pursue sensual desire. And then and the harm that comes from ill will, hostility. And probably you're familiar with being in the receiving end of that, and maybe sometimes in the giving end of it, and know the consequences of it. And so here what he's doing is doing a very interesting thing. He's examining it and understanding the consequences. And in understanding the consequences, then he doesn't say, then I thought it was bad and I should get rid of it like that, just like and moralistically. It's more like I saw the consequences, and seeing the consequences, it subsided. And this has to do with really having wisdom, really having understanding, not having moralistic judgments, simplistic judgments about things, but really taking time to get to know what's going on for us, really being in touch with ourselves in a deep way, and feeling and seeing and sensing and intuiting how this works, the consequences. And then there's wisdom, and then it's a lot easier to let these things subside, to let go of them, because you see that it causes harm. It's like taking out a thorn that's stuck in your sole of your foot. You take it out, you keep walking in it because you understand it hurts. So he divides his thoughts into two kinds, and then he when he sees when a thought of letting go arises, or a thought of goodwill or of compassion, that it does not lead to affliction of anyone, does not obstruct wisdom. And this is one that's good to have. And so then you can abide content and happy. In describing this, he also makes a very important statement that has been said but in other ways by other people. He says, whatever a person frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of mind. So if you're constantly repeatedly thinking the same thing over and over again, that becomes kind of a habit, or becomes kind of an underlying attitude by which we then approach our life or look upon our life and we approach things. So some care should go into looking at what are we thinking? What are our attitudes? What do we keep repeating for ourselves over and over again? What's the self-talk that you have about yourself? What's the self-talk you have about what goes on around you? One of the things that about the wrong intentions of sensual desire and ill will and cruelty, harm, is that sometimes they function as forms of escape from personal pain. When we feel challenged, feel lonely, feel scared, feel angry, feel hurt in some deep way, it's not uncommon for some people to utilize one of these three attitudes as a way to somehow get relief, or to get away, or to avoid, or to cover over. So to go into the world of sensual desire as a way of escape, to go into the world of ill will, somehow trying to cope with it, to assign blame, or to somehow seemingly try to push it away. And sometimes it can work when we blame other people, if they cooperate. But it's really deadly when we blaming ourselves, ill will towards ourselves, because it's kind of this loop that we get caught up in. It feels bad to to blame yourself. It feels bad. I mean, poor you, to be on the receiving end of it. So you feel worse. And so then, since you have this good strategy going of ill will, and then you have more reason to get angry, and now you're really bad. Now you're really bad, doing it wrong, and that makes you feel worse. And so it can get some people can spiral down into deep depression because of this. They're kind of stuck in this loop of doing something that feels hard and difficult, and then the response to it creates more difficulty, and so this ill will cycles. But it's a way to get away. And then there's cruelty as well, you know, to actually be involved in causing harm or wanting to cause harm, planning it. It's a little bit different than ill will, which is kind of hostile, you know, having hostile thoughts versus having thoughts of doing something hostile. And when I went to San Quentin earlier this year, I go there once a year to visit a program there of inmates. And it was really touching to hear these lifers, who many of them had committed murder, who talked about, they had this concept of original pain and secondary pain. And original pain was the pain that they had experienced. All of them were as children. And I think every single one of them had to do with their father. So their father had left, had done violence to themselves or their mother, or had died when they were young. Something, some trauma. I mean, they told us, some of them told us their story, and it was pretty hard to listen to the traumas, the difficulties they'd gone through as children. And they described how they learned to see that this was their original pain, and they spent the rest of their life trying to avoid feeling it. And that their act of crime, and then the criminal life that they got involved in, whether it was harming other people or robbing or taking drugs or alcohol or whatever they did, were ways of trying to avoid experiencing their primary pain, the original pain. So, you know, it's a strong instinct of what we have to avoid feeling our discomfort, feeling our pain, feeling our difficulties. And sometimes these unskillful attitudes is part of the strategy to do that. And then we have this whole other strategy, you know, way of living, which kind of, I think, in many ways underpins most of what's really good in our society, and that is people's ability to, for goodwill, loving kindness, love, people's ability for compassion, and people's ability to let go. All three are deeply, deeply a part of, you know, healthy, successful, loving, caring communities, to some degree, to have those operating there. In my own journey through these three right intentions, was in reverse order in the way the Buddha listed them. So for me, it was compassion, discovering compassion, then discovering loving kindness, and then really beginning to understand the value of letting go in a deeper way, and deeper ways. And when I first came to Buddhist practice, I had a lot of suffering. And I was, I think, very lucky that I didn't learn Vipassana first. So I apologize to those of you who are learning it new here, that maybe you got it wrong, and you didn't get it wrong, but maybe my lesson from doing it through Zen was, in Zen, we were not given any instruction except to sit still. And so what I learned was sit still and practice radical acceptance, or unconditional acceptance of the present moment as it was. That was the only thing I thought I was supposed to do. And I hadn't read about you could get concentrated, or that you could be mindful, or that states of meditation to attain. And so I was very lucky not to know so much. I hadn't read so much. I just learned to, you're supposed to sit there and practice unconditional acceptance of what is. So I didn't have a problem. I meant I didn't have any problems, particularly with what was going on. I just had to be there fully with it. But because I had so much personal suffering, it meant I got to sit with a lot of my suffering. I sat with it, just bed, and it was kind of like very tenderizing to do that, to just sit and be present. The language I used for myself back then was that my heart was crusted over. And this practice of unconditional acceptance of what is was the tenderizer, like the meat tenderizer, that made it soft. And I didn't know how to do that, but there's just that presence, just simple presence, just being with it. And sometimes that all the efforts to try to do something and fix it and heal it and get away from it and get concentrated to override it and, you know, all these kind of things to try to efforts to fix it sometimes get in the way of really allowing the heart to do its own work that needs to be done. And just to be present for it is a hugely important part of this process. And so what I realized, what happened in retrospect after some years of doing this and looking back at what was happening to me, that I became compassionate. That I was slowly learning, my heart was opening, and I started to feel more and more compassion. And compassion became the central operating principle, the central kind of motivating force in my life. And that was quite a phenomenal transformation over some years, to recognize that in some ways the heart of, I felt like the heart of who I had become was someone motivated by compassion. I wasn't looking for that. And then when I started doing Vipassana practice, I wasn't sitting so much with my suffering anymore, because I'd already done that. And some of it had been resolved and settled. And so now, this tender heart, this tender place that started opening up through Vipassana practice took the form of the birth of loving kindness, for metta. And I thought that was quite remarkable. And one of the ways I thought it was remarkable was I could feel, when I really kind of settled in and was really present and really willing to be here in a simple way, I could feel love, goodwill, metta, without an object. It didn't have to be directed towards anyone. It just was. And I'm kind of a rational kind of guy, and I like to have reasons for things, what I do. And to have love for no reason, that was strange at first. But isn't that pretty cool, that the heart can have the ability to have goodwill and love for no reason? It just is, as opposed to, you know, having to have a reason, look for a reason and try to drum it up. Just it is. And I attribute a lot to it, again, not to doing it, making it, but rather this tenderizing effect, this willingness to just really be here for this, with this experience, and letting the heart just be present and open. And then as I did this, and these things began to develop in me, then I had a deeper and deeper appreciation of the value of letting go of that which obstructs it, that which obstructs the sense of well-being and settledness and connectedness and good heart. And I had a greater appreciation of how, if I could do this, let go of some of my attachments that I had, and sensual desires sometimes that I had that didn't seem to be so skillful, that it was really for the betterment of myself and others as well. Made for a better world to live in. And so it became interesting and valuable to let go. So I tended not to use that scary word for my own practice, the renunciation word. I was content to use the word letting go. And lately someone taught me a nice thing about the word letting go that I think is really great. It had never occurred to me. I kind of associate letting go a little bit like dropping something. But literally letting go means let it move. Isn't that nice? Let it move. Let it move on. you don't have to get rid of it. Just let it, everything wants to go, so just let it go. And so let it pass on. No, thank you. I'm not going to do that. You can just keep going. So the second of the three right intentions is goodwill, love, loving kindness, metta. And we have that capacity deep inside of us, possibility. And a tremendous amount of our society runs on it. And one of the interesting experiences that if your new parents sometimes have, is to only then realize, wait a minute, my parents did this for me? Oh, they did all this for me? I mean, this is a lot of work taking care of a small cat. Wow. And they did it? I didn't realize they, you know, I had no idea that they were up late at night and getting up and early in the morning and dealing with all the stuff. And it's quite something. And so, you know, even though later as the kids get older, sometimes it gets more interesting, the dynamics. But the kids get older, it gets more interesting, the dynamics, right? But you know, there's a strong instinct for goodwill, for kindness. Some of us here today were talking about the cats that are here. We have this one of the black cats called Whiskers. And both cats, when they first showed up here, were pretty skittish. I think they had a lot of fear. I don't know what happened to them in their lives. And they've been here for many years now, I think. Whiskers has probably been here the longest, maybe 4 years now, maybe 4 or 5 years. And it's really remarkable to watch how this cat has slowly, slowly relaxed and starting to feel trust and feel like safe here. And now it's kind of relaxed around people here in a way it wasn't some years ago. And this instinct towards, you know, this possibility of offering enough safety and kindness for the heart, the mind, the fear to relax is quite something. And then, you know, I think that some of them are fellow mammals in the mammal kingdom. Sometimes you see great acts of kindness and love and caretaking among them. A few years ago, I went out here on the Santa Cruz with whale watching, and the whale watching guide said that they had seen one of these big whales, humpback maybe, I forget what kind it was, gray whale, protect a seal from an orca. Why should a whale care? I mean, it's a different species. But that the whale would care, right? It's this instinct that maybe a mammalian, I don't know if reptiles have it. I don't know where it is, but you know, we have this deep, deep conditioning towards having a soft, caring, kind heart. And it's been a very gratifying journey to work with, to explore, to struggle with, to argue with all the tendencies I have towards not having goodwill at times. You know, and it still happens sometimes that I'm having some conflict with people and I'm carrying with me my resentment and my, you know, I'll have goodwill for everyone, but I don't know about that person. You know, that person, you know, then I come up with good reason why, and, you know, this person's treated me really unkindly, really badly, and if someone treats me that badly, then, you know, of course I'm not going to reciprocate with goodwill. And so then I have to kind of have a talk with myself and kind of like look what's going on and kind of work my way through it. And there's several ways which I work through it. One way is if I have that, I try to go find the person so I can be in their presence. Because when I'm just left to my own mind and thoughts, I'm living kind of an imagination of things, and it's very easy to get stuck in certain images and ideas. But with the person, I find it much harder for me to stay locked in my assumptions about the person. And much more my heart opens, and it's much more productive to find a way forward. But I also find that this thing that the Buddha said here about affliction is that I recognize that I'm really harming myself when I'm holding my heart cold, closed to someone else. And then I eventually come to the idea that, yeah, maybe that person doesn't deserve any goodwill from me whatsoever, but they're going to get it anyway. Because it's just too painful for me not to. It just, you know, to have this heavy heart and closed heart and, you know, so in spite of a certain part of myself, you know, I'm going to give it to that sucker. I'm not going to keep my heart closed, and you know, and the thing about it is that I don't always tell the person that. It doesn't necessarily translate to action, because if it's going to translate to action, it gets complicated. You know, social dynamics are complicated, right? But it makes a huge difference. At least my heart shifts, the attitude changes, and my attitude towards the person becomes one of goodwill. Kind of, I care for this person. I want the best for this person. And it's a hard relationship, and the, you know, conversations are difficult. And I think I'm better off maybe not getting involved with this person, not getting engaged. That just maybe seems wiser at this point. But at least I have this goodwill for the person, and with that, I often try to, if it's sincere on my part, when I talk, if I have to talk about them with third parties, then I try to speak from that place of my goodwill for them. Rather than my, do you know what that person said? I say, you know what that person's, so whatever. I try to say things that are supportive behind the person's back. So, why do this? Why focus on goodwill? One reason is the opposite causes harm to yourself, causes harm to others, causes harm to us as a community. The other is that it nourishes us. It really points us towards freedom. It points us to not being contracted or closed. And so the movement towards freedom is found through love and compassion, because you can't have love and compassion without that opening, without that generosity of heart that's there. And so to recognize that that's in us. I don't want to sit up here and say that you should have loving kindness, you should be compassionate. But I would like to encourage you to see if you can find it and recognize it in yourself. Okay, is there that inkling? Is there the instinct towards it? Is there the desire for it? Is there a tendency for it? Does it live in you? And is it an attitude that you can incline your heart to, incline yourself to? Is it one that you can call forth in a healthy way, not artificially, but can you bring it forth? So that as you meet all your experiences here, maybe that you kind of meet it with a friendliness, with goodwill. So if you find yourself feeling hostility, you don't have to feel bad about yourself for being that way. If you feel strong aversion, ill will towards someone, you don't have to, just don't do it, but you don't act on it. But you don't feel bad about yourself for having ill will. But you could bring your attention to it and really hold it, be present for it. Chances are very good that if you feel anger or ill will towards someone, including yourself, that that's a signal that something inside of you really needs attention, something really needs caring attention, needs to be held, needs your presence. And it begins with bringing caring presence to that hostility, to the ill will. So can you be friendly towards your ill will? Is a task. And, you know, 1% friendly is pretty good. You know, you don't want to set the bar too high, because then you can get, you know, frustrated, and then one consequence of frustration is more ill will. So you know, it's good to start low, just a low bar. 1% goodwill towards, you know, whatever's going on. But can you find that? Can you recognize it? Can you call it forth? Can it be kind of a something you remind yourself about? So if you're doing your work around the center here, you know, it's an interesting place, the work, because that's when we're supporting each other. At that point, can you reflect ahead of time and during? How can you have an attitude of doing this that really is supportive, is generous, is friendly, is kind? It's caring for the community you're with. Is there some way that you can do that sincerely? You know, something that can come from the deep source within. And I say that because I know from my own life how easy it is to get into old habits and of, you know, just things have to be done. And so if a task needs to be done, I try to do it as quickly as I can, or mostly I'm doing it worried that other people are going to judge me if I don't do it right. And so I'm constantly looking over my shoulder, and more doing out of fear than anything else. Or just kind of oblivious, you know. I'll be diligent when I've been on retreats where I'm pretty good doing the meditation during the sitting time, the walking time. But the work time, isn't that like a break? My mind has all kinds of interesting things to think about. So, you know, I don't have any attitude towards my work. My attitude is, you know, off in Timbuktu with my thoughts somewhere. So to take time, intentional time, conscious time, to consider, to bring with you a gentle, easy attitude as you do your activities. Don't force it, don't make it heavy work, but can you kind of in a light touch consider and bring forth an attitude of how you do what you do that's supportive of you, that's helpful for you. Not so much, again, to force anything to happen, but more like to water the seeds, to water a tender plant, that as you water it, it can grow. I think of things like goodwill and compassion and this kind of healthy letting go. I think of it as being much shyer than sometimes greed or lust or anger, hostility can be. And so the shy voice inside of us, can you make time for it? Can you look for it and allow for it? And can you do it in such a way that it helps settle the mind, settle the heart, help it become quieter, more at ease? Can you meet your anger? Can you meet your fear? And hold it and be with it so that it feels safe enough to relax by itself. I think all these forces inside of us have within them the opportunity to relax if they feel safe. And so part of the goodwill, the loving kindness that we do, the friendliness, is to help these difficult things inside of us to feel safe. And it's kind of a paradox to say that part of the function of mindfulness practice or practice is to help our fear feel safe. Probably it's kind of like some people recoil from their fear, or they're afraid of their fear, or they're trying to fix their fear. But perhaps that fear doesn't need anything more from you than for you to hold it gently and reassure it, it's okay. It's okay for you to be here right now. And I'll be with you, I'll hold you, I'll be present. It's a generous, kind thing to do. Same thing with anger, same thing with deep hurt, same thing with resentment. Same thing with our delusion and our confusion. It can help it feel safe. And then maybe something can relax. Then sometimes our wisdom can operate. Then maybe we can have insight and see more deeply what's going on. But to be in a hurry to fix and to do away with and obliterate what's going on, I don't think it really respects this deeper process. So one of the approaches to this way of practicing is loving kindness. And there's not a few people who have come to the conclusion that as mindfulness matures, that it becomes almost synonymous with loving kindness, almost synonymous with love. And a very powerful way that I've learned to see this, that really seeing, bringing mindful attention, really seeing what's there is a kind of love, is from the many stories I've heard during the interviews that I've had on retreat over these many years. And one of the deep-seated sources of suffering for people that travel continues into adulthood is, sometimes it's more difficult because it happens so chronically growing up for some people, more difficult than certain traumas, is not being seen when they were kids. They had parents who kind of ignored them, and really, I mean, not kind of, but complete negligence, and they weren't seen, they weren't recognized, they weren't mirrored. No one loved them, no one saw them. And then sometimes people say, yeah, I wasn't seen, no one saw me growing up. And it's the same as not feeling any love or care. And to be seen and to be loved are almost synonymous. And so when we practice this simple practice of mindfulness, a willingness to see, to be present, it's an act of love, whether you know it or not. Just to see and be present for this, for here, for now. So for this, for you on this retreat, coming here, I believe, whether you know it or not, it's my belief, my faith, my trust, my something, that your act of coming here was motivated by a kind of love, a kind of love and caring for yourself and maybe for your society as well. And that, you know, if you came here because you're suffering, it's a great thing that you came to kind of address that and work with that, to meet yourself. If you came here to really see what's here and be present, it's an act of love, care. So I'll end with one more quote from this sutta. Sutta is called The Two Kinds of Thought. This kind of remarkable kind of, listen to this kind of turn that happens as the Buddha talks about this. As I abided thus, a thought of goodwill arose in me, and a thought of non-cruelty or compassion arose in me. And I understood this thought of goodwill and this thought of compassion has arisen. They do not lead to my own affliction, to the affliction of others, or to the affliction of both. They aid wisdom, do not cause difficulties, and lead to Nibbana. And here goes this very interesting next little turn. However, if I think and ponder upon this thought, even for a night, even for a day, even for a night and day, I see nothing to fear from it. That's good. But with excessive thinking and pondering, I might get tired. And when I'm tired, my mind becomes strained. And when the mind is strained, it is far from concentration. So I steadied my mind, quieted it, brought it to singleness, and concentrated it. Why is that? So that my mind should not be strained. So it's kind of interesting that this idea that as wonderful, as important as goodwill is, letting go is, compassion is, if you spend too much time thinking about it, you're going to get tired. And if you get tired, your mind won't be able to be settled and concentrated. So there becomes a time, and hopefully you'll know the time, when you want to be able to let go of any active involvement, reflections, thinkings, practices of loving kindness and compassion, letting go of and renunciation, and in favor, instead, to help let the mind get still, get unified, get collected, get steadied. This will lead you deeper and deeper into some of the most beautiful places that resides inside of you. And it's my belief that as we settle into this deep, quiet place inside, we're really sensitive, really connected to our hearts in a deep way, that the instincts that we operate under will be the instincts that are skillful, that are wise. And from that, we can trust our responses to the world. We trust that what comes forth. And so we all have treasures inside. We all have beautiful things. And so, as I said, the opening night, we're kind of digging for treasure. And isn't it pretty cool and wonderful to know that in your heart there's a treasure waiting for you? Maybe you already know. There's beauty in each of you. So let's take a minute to get recollected and steadied and quieted. May your goodwill radiate outwards like the ring of the bell.